Is that okay?
Got, this is page two.
Oh, page two.
Of Senate Bill 629, we put out a third sheet just in case.
Okay, great. All right, are we ready to go? Okay, the Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. We have a couple of really quick work sessions to do that will be lickety-split, and then we will move in and out of some hearings to accommodate some members. So I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 616.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 616 was previously heard on February 24th. Requires treasurer, which has been altered by the Dash 1 amendment, to investigate community housing trust account with Department of Human Services assistance, specifies the focus of the investigation, and requires the development of an investment strategy and a report to the legislature by February 1st of 2016. The Dash 1 amendment, which is before you and posted on OLIS, has minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and substitutes the Secretary of State for the Treasurer, as was discussed at the hearing on the 24th,
yep,
and makes other adjustments to capture the credits to the fund.
Doing our part to add to Secretary Atkins' to-do list. Senator Olson.
Chair Gilster, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 3-4-2015.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 3-4-2015. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Gilster, I move Senate Bill 616. As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 616 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing, we're on 616, the Fairview bill. Okay. So seeing no objection, the motion passes. And if it's okay with all of you, I would like to carry this bill.
Your
so,
bill, why
no.
not?
No?
Where are you?
No, are you going to vote me down? All right, so I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 616 and open a work session on Senate Bill 617. And Senator Olson, it's the Dash 2 amendment. Oh, Cheyenne.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 617 was also previously heard on February 24th. It establishes a task force on housing for persons with intellectual or developmental disabilities, specifies the composition, scope, and formalities, and directs the Department of Human Services to provide staffing. It also requires a report to the legislature on September 15th, 2016, and sunsets December 31st, 2016. The Dash 2 amendment increases the number of task force members from 7 to 13 as specified in the measure, and it removes a reference to a group home model. The Dash 2 has no revenue, and a fiscal statement has issued and has been made available. It's also at the dais. There is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Vice Chair Olson.
Well, first thing I'd like to say, it'd be nice to know who wrote the Dash 2. Oh, that's right. We don't have that amendment.
I wrote the Dash 2,
Senator
Olson.
Thank you very much.
With the help of Leslie Sutton from the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities.
Yeah, the reason I said that is I have a bill that means you have to put your name on amendments so we know who wrote them. Chair Gilster, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 3-9-2015.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments authored by Senator Gilster dated 3-9-2015. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the amendments? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Gilster, I move 617 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 617 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? I would just note for the record that one of the changes here was that the Council on Developmental Disabilities was going to take on the work of the task force, and they believe they can do that within existing resources. So hopefully this should not require any general fund allocation, which is always a nice quality in a bill. Right. Is there any objection to the bill moving forward? Seeing none, the motion passes, and it does not need a carrier because it's going down to our RENZIT budget. With that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 617 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 632. And I would invite Senator Shields and Representative Stark and Cheyenne.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 632 requires the Department of Human Services administer a pilot program to improve outcomes for those in its custody or foster care. It establishes requirements for the program, including cultural training, targeting those who have experienced multiple placements, and implementation in both rural and urban regions. Requires evaluation and report to the legislature by September of 2016, appropriates $1 million general fund dollars, sunsets January 2, 2017, declares an emergency is effective on passage, and has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. And welcome both to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'll lead off. My name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate, District 22. The idea behind Senate Bill 632 is that Oregon, I think, has made some advances in trying to keep kids out of foster care. But even if we do a very good job on that, we're still on any given day going to have 7,000 or 8,000 kids in foster care. And I think we owe it to them now to provide a really secure home of healing. And what this bill would do is create two pilot projects where we would use evidence-based practices to do a couple of things. One is to upskill foster parents and provide the kind of support that they need to make their foster home a true home of healing, and thereby decrease some of the behaviors that are the most challenging from traumatized kids, and that would then result in fewer placements and better care in those placements. And that's the general idea behind it. We will plan on amending the bill because Senator Winters had a very good suggestion, was that, you know, it's pretty open-ended right now, but she felt that we should really focus down on what kind of services that we would be providing. And Catholic Community Services, as well as the Oregon Social Learning Center, some of the people at the forefront of doing great work on fostering, have sat down and tried to map out what that might look like to really get us to a point where we can turn each foster home in Oregon to a true home of healing. This would be a good step in that direction. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Stark, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dwayne Stark, State Rep, House District 4, which is Southern Oregon between Grants Pass and Medford. So it's Central Point, White City, Gold Hill, Rogue River. It's pretty much every point around there, Eagle Point, all those. So I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 632, but not necessarily as a state rep, instead as a foster parent and as a foster family. My wife and I have a lot of experience in this industry, and we've been foster parents for 6 years. We're adoptive parents as well. We have, you know, several boys or a couple boys with us right now through the foster system. And, you know, foster parents, they're really like any other parent. They parent because they love their children. But what's unique about foster parents is that they open up their homes to children who have some special circumstances. And because of that, they take really individualized training for that. The department right now offers significant training for foster parents. And I've been through that training several times. I've helped with that training on occasion. And it's most of the time it's adequate. But we all hear about children who blow out of homes is the term in the industry. And I want to share a story with you that I went through a couple summers ago. We had a young boy come into our house. And, you know, young boy was – fortunately, we're very specific on what ages we take in because we've done this for a little while, so we know what our other children can handle and what they can't. So we brought in a boy who was six, and he was, you know, quite a bit smaller than my two oldest children. And lo and behold, about a month after he was there, we discovered that he had some very violent tendencies. And praise God that my children had learned Kung Fu, and they had actually learned how to break chokeholds. Because on a regular basis, this child would try to choke, or actually would choke, my other children. And they would break out of it, and they could step back. Now, in the average foster home, with average training, this is a child that would probably blow through that family pretty quick and move on somewhere else, because most foster parents don't have degrees in psychology. But what was unique for us is that my wife and I both do have degrees in psychology, and she is a licensed counselor, and we have advanced training. So one of the things I've done is reflect on some of the differences between the training given through the normal foster parent training and some of the trainings that I've received as I've worked in residential treatment for troubled youth. There are things I've been a trainer for collaborative problem solving, which is a great treatment module. I've been a trainer for organ intervention systems, so I was able to actually teach my family how to break chokeholds and how to escape and evade and so forth. And it's unfortunate when these tactics are ever needed. Okay, we hope and pray that they aren't ever needed, but occasionally they are. And there are some very significant ways, some very simplistic ways that we can begin integrating those trainings that wouldn't be a huge burden on DHS, but instead would actually provide additional training so that these children wouldn't blow through homes. And what happens oftentimes if they are blowing through homes is they end up in treatment, foster care, which cost a whole lot more. And I think that we can integrate these systems, so I'm excited to be a part of a program or a pilot program, both in rural and urban Oregon, to give these parents and really study this, to give them additional supports. Again, actually, my wife and I have both worked at OSLC in the past, and so I was pleased to hear that some of the research that they're doing there might have an opportunity to be applied to this. You know, there's self-care issues, there's 24/7 hotline issues, all these things that are already available for treatment foster care. But let's make that available to regular foster care as well.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel?
I have some.
Senator Olson.
Thank you very much. Either can answer, and I hope it will be Senator Shields. No, I will ask you. These children come to these families, and I read in here that they've lifelong emotional behavioral development problems. When these children are placed, will this program first teach the new foster parents what the problem is and explain to them how to react to the problem and how to deal with the child? Or will it be one of these where we place the child and then the parents are taught how to handle it during the placement of the, or with the placement of the child? If you understand what I'm saying, then.
Yeah, which comes first?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I've been around the block enough to let the certified smart people answer the tough questions.
Okay.
They'll be coming up shortly, but I think the purpose is to kind of do things simultaneously. Let's upskill the foster parents. I'm not sure if that would happen, you know, before, during, or after.
Okay. Follow up.
And
do you have, you say rural and urban, do you have at this point or at this moment planned areas that you've looked at and selected, or will that be if this bill moves through?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think that they could apply. It would be open to any community-based organization or even a DHS office in, say, for example, Burns, if there's not a community-based organization there that does the actual work.
So you haven't chosen cities or areas
at this time? There, we helped craft it with the Oregon Social Learning Center. Catholic Community Services also has an interest, so they're kind of coming together, but it wouldn't be restricted to them applying.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I'd like to respond to Senator Olson's first question. You know, to my understanding, that the pilot program will focus on children, and so they can correct me if I'm wrong or wherever they're at in the room, will focus on children who have had multiple placements, and that's, you know, obviously because we know there's a problem that exists there. But however, ideally it goes on to parents, foster parents who are just entering the system, because you usually don't know when a child first comes in. The child I talked about a minute ago, we were there, his first placement, official placement. And so we had no idea that he was going to have that behavior. And sometimes it takes a while for that behavior to manifest. And so ideally, you're going to have both.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dimbrough.
Thanks, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to say I really appreciate the fact that this bill is coming from two people who are made the commitment to, you know, to help with the foster system and are yourself foster parents. And that means a lot, I think, that, you know, that you're speaking from that direct experience. I do think it's a good idea to flesh out the bill a little through amendments in terms of what, you know, what sorts of things might be included in the pilot, questions such as, you know, multiple placements and some of the others. And I don't know if you two have been thinking about what some of those other things might be, or if those are questions we could ask people who come after you.
Madam Chair, Senator Dimbrough, yes, those are things that particularly the Oregon Social Learning Center and Catholic Community Services have been negotiating to put into the bill.
Great.
To tighten it up.
Thank you very much. Further questions?
Madam Chair, before we go, I did want to put on the record that I have been a foster parent and that I'm also a board member of the Oregon Foster Parent Association. They asked me to also mention that they support this bill.
Fantastic. And I really appreciate both of you coming and bringing this forward. Representative Stark, I don't know if this is your first time in a Senate hearing. I have an affinity for the House, so I've gotten to spend some time with you, and I just urge the rest of you to spend some time getting to know the good representative. We're really fortunate to have you in the body. Your passion and common sense are going to serve all of us and people of Oregon really well, so thank you. And I had one question about your district. Is it true that Doc Baker from Little House on the Prairie lived in your district?
He used to live in Grants Pass. And in fact, I grew up with him living about a mile down the road from me. And so I didn't discover that until after he had passed. So, yes.
That's pretty exciting. The ringtone on my cell phone is the Little House on the Prairie theme
Yes,
song.
Hamilton Lane, Grants Pass.
All right, thank you very much.
Can we try it?
So, no, never. It's on silent, as it's supposed to be in the committee. So I'm going to, yes, Senator Stark.
Actually, correction, that is a quarter mile outside of my current district. So
I take back all the nice things I said.
I think it's a quarter mile outside.
Thank you both very much. Well, so I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 632 so we can get Senator Shields' comments on the other bill. Then we're going to come back to this bill and then go back to the other bill. Senator Shields' day in our committee. So I'm temporarily closing Senate Bill 632 and temporarily opening Senate Bill 629. Cheyenne.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 629 establishes the Oregon Right to Rest Act. It enumerates rights of homeless persons in public spaces to use, move freely, rest, take shelter, give, receive, and eat food, meditate, engage in religious practice, and occupy vehicles without harassment by law enforcement, security personnel, or local government. Creates a private right of action and an unlawful practice enforceable via the Bureau of Labor and Industries. There's no subsequent referral.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate, District 22. I'm also the chief co-sponsor of Senate Bill 629, otherwise known as the Right to Rest Act. I drafted the bill at the request of the Western Regional Advocacy Project in coalition with Sisters of the Road and Right to Dream 2. The reason I drafted the bill is quite simply, at its core, Senate Bill 629 is about this, equality and fairness. People who are homeless not only struggle with life on the street, they struggle with the indignity of being treated like criminals because they have nowhere to eat, sit, or sleep. Some sobering statistics for you. In the U.S. Housing and Urban Development's annual homeless assessment report to Congress, Oregon ranked last among five states with the highest number of unsheltered, unoccupied homeless children and youth. Oregon's Education Department released its K-12 homeless student count at about 20,000 kids experienced homelessness during the 2013-14 school year. That's the equivalent of almost every seat in Providence Park filled with kids who don't know where they're going to sleep at night. It's also double the amount of students who experienced homelessness just 10 years ago. As the Oregonian's recent special report on homelessness illustrates, the recession greatly expanded the number of people facing homelessness in the state. And yet we have cut the number of emergency shelter beds available. For many individuals facing homelessness, there simply is nowhere to go but public spaces. SB 632 is about ensuring that those individuals facing homelessness have the same rights as individuals with homes. When I was talking to my wife about the bill, she made a great analogy. She stated that, you know, the person pushing the shopping cart down the street with all their precious possessions inside should be treated with the same dignity and respect as the woman pushing her baby buggy. Their persons should be respected. Their possessions should be respected. SB 632 gets us a step in that direction. Later on, you'll hear firsthand from individuals about their experience with homelessness and their views on SB 632. I'm also aware that there are a number of people in the building with concerns in the bill, and I've asked folks who have come to my office to clarify the language in the bill that concerns them and to provide suggested language to address their concerns. My office and RAP are happy to work on amendments. To that end, you will find on OLIS 2 amendment my office drafted at the request of RAP. The amendment tries to address the following. One, RAP's concern that the bill not provide special rights to homeless people. The amendment should clarify that the fundamental rights are no different whether you have a house or not. And two, clarify Boley's concern that it would be hard to prove that discrimination was based solely on housing status. So I thank you, Madam Chair, for taking the time to consider this bill, and I'm happy to punt any questions to the certified smart people who will come after me.
Thank you. Are there any questions that you want to toss at Senator Shields to see if he punts them? Seeing none. Thank you. Thank you very much. All right, so now I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 629 and reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 632. And I'll invite up Elizabeth Kushwa, Eliza Carlston, and Peter Springlemeyer. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Senator Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa. I'm the Strategic Director for Children First for Oregon, and I'm here today testifying on behalf of Lisa McMahon, who's the Program Manager for the Oregon Foster Youth Connection, and she couldn't be here today and sends her regrets. Senate Bill 632 is a bill whose time has come here in Oregon, and it has not strictly come in Oregon. Yesterday, there was an article in a Texas newspaper about there being a bill in Texas to increase the training for foster parents as well, where the training for nail technicians requires more hours than the training for foster parents. So that's something to seriously consider. In addition, when we were talking about this bill, we asked, okay, so how many places train foster parents? And even the Foster Youth Connection did not know the answer to that question. How many trainings are there? I think this bill would put really nice sideboards, provide some guidelines on what training is, what it should look like, and what a measurable outcome should look like as well. So we're in full support of this bill for increasing training. We did speak to Senator Shields and have a few things for your consideration, which I believe will be added for the amendments. In Section 1 of the bill, where the programs are required to provide culturally appropriate training and support, we'd like to add also trauma-informed training. But while all of the foster children do not necessarily require culturally appropriate training, nearly all of them require trauma-informed training. Additionally, when the program is being developed or if there is an advisory group, we strongly recommend that a foster youth or a former foster youth, as well as a foster parent, sit on that advisory board and help to inform what the training should look like. Also, the Foster Youth Connection is happy to work to help develop any evaluation criteria or other guidelines as well. Additionally, just a couple of questions to consider. You know, it requires evaluation. Is DHS the best evaluator? Perhaps, but maybe independent evaluation is another way to go. I think those questions should be looked at carefully. A one-year time frame we've heard is brief. As you've heard, kids often blow out. And if they have made a connection with that foster parent, sometimes they return based upon that training. And so just when we're looking at a one-year pilot, maybe 1 year isn't long enough when it comes to something like this. So all in all, the Oregon Foster Youth Connection and Children First for Oregon are both in support of Senate Bill 632 with these small tweaks. And at this time, I'd like to introduce to you Eliza Carlson, who knows this firsthand. Thank you.
Hi, Senator Gelson and other committee members. I'm Eliza Carlson, and I was in foster care for 5 years. I was in 30 different placements within that time period. Most of them were not quite as they should be. I remember having three that were on like high standards. Like, they were supportive, they cared about the youth, they were like parents, like actual parents. They didn't treat us any different. And I think that's the most important part of being a foster kid, is having that support system, is having a home that you feel safe in, and being able to have people who care about you there 24/7. And people who understand. If there was any sort of things that were bothering us from previous homes, we felt confident enough to say, hey, this happened, this shouldn't happen. And then I think also having some kind of support system for the foster parents as well, having a group where foster parents can go and meet other foster parents and share their experiences and give advice from people who have been doing it for a while and know what to say, and can say, well, this is the person you should contact if there's something going on with this, or you should see this counselor for this specific reason, or anything like that. And I did have a meeting with Portland State University, who does have a training program for social workers as well as homes, the foster parent homes. What I found out there is that when they go out into the field and actually do their job, they only have the textbook version. They don't really know what to expect, so they can't really give specific answers to foster parents or caseworkers, brand new caseworkers. They don't really know how to react when someone says, hey, something's going on in this home and I think I should be moved. They didn't really have those skills necessarily to, like a one-on-one experience. So I actually got to know a little bit of the new caseworkers, and they said that when we went and told them what it was like and how to say certain things to foster youth or what to look for in foster homes to know maybe this isn't maybe the quite right fit, they said that really helped them, and they wished that there was more training like that where foster youth were actually able to go and say how they felt and things that helped them when they were in foster care.
Thank you so much. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you too.
Madam Chair, Senators, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about Senate Bill 632. My name is Peter Springlemeyer. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Social Learning Center, the OSLC Community Programs down in Eugene. We run empirically validated programs and have about 70 foster homes in Lane County that we help support, but also do training with the models that are developed at OSLC, University of Oregon, and ORI out into the broader community. A recent survey from Children's First in 2014 noted there's about 1.5% of children in Oregon who are in foster care. That's almost double the national average of 0.9%. We have a lot of kids in foster care by comparison. At the same time, Oregon ranks 26 in terms of the rate at which placement stability for those foster children, and 47th for the percentage of those children who have a long-term plan of emancipation or for long-term care. Most of our kids are on a trajectory to stay in foster care, and we don't do a very good job of returning those kids back home. Rubin et al. Surveyed 1,600 kids in foster care, found that 41% had three or more placements. And the correlation between the number of placements kids have and the mental health services that they need and receive is a very direct and linear one. The top 10% of kids in mental health services accounted for 83% of the cost for those kids. Kids enter the system as a result of trauma and unrest. We then don't support those foster parents, and as they move from home to home, they're separated from friends, they're separated from family, they're separated from school, and as they enter adolescence and young adulthood, we start to diagnose them with attachment disorders and disruptive behavior disorders. Not everyone escapes as cleanly and as well adjusted as this young lady here. And that, so we foist those difficulties back on the kids. At the same time, Casey Family Foundation reports that almost half of foster parents quit within the first year of placement. 20 to 25% of those foster parents quit within the following year, and a quarter present uncertainty about continuing. Not only are the kids disrupting, but our foster parents are leaving the system too. And that's been my personal experience. Doing a training in the UK a few years ago, I met with a foster parent certifier who had been certifying homes for decades. And he said that as part of our program, as we talked with him, he had told foster parents what their house rules should be for years and years. But this was the first time he had ever asked a foster parent what the rules in their home were. It's a different kind of a conversation when you take it up to bring the foster parents into the table. We protect kids by bringing them into the system, but at the same time we're making them vulnerable to the system. And we need to support them, and probably the best way to support them is by supporting the foster parents. One way to support them, but supporting the foster parents who are working with them. For kids, the number of prior placement predicts the rate of disruption. The more foster parent disruptions get, the more disruptions from homes they have, the more likelihood there will be a further disruption. One or two disruptions, you're more likely to have a disruption. By the time you're eight or nine disruptions, you may as well not unpack your bags because this placement isn't going to last very long. But you don't have to wait until their placements are disrupted. Like you were hearing from the earlier testimony, little behaviors can predict this. We have a 5 to 10 minute phone call, a parent daily report, where we can ask foster parents about behaviors, and reports on that are highly predictive of placement disruptions. Six or more behaviors on the PDR means that there's a significant risk that child's going to disrupt from that home and that they're at need for support. It's not just the big behaviors, though. Assaults, sexual behavior, fire setting, of course, are related to disruptions, but it's also the little behaviors, the talking back, the cursing, the not attending school, the leaving without permission and not coming back home that drive foster parents to distraction and eventually disrupt those homes. I was able to bring my son here. The relationship you have with a biological sibling, a child who's been in your home for throughout the years, is a different kind of a relational context than it is in foster parenting and the relationship you have with a foster parent. And
that might be the case whether it's a biological child or a child that's been with you since birth that you aren't genetically related to.
For sure. And so people come forward to do foster parenting, and they're good parents, and they know what they're doing, and they do that well. And then they get a whole host of different kids through their door as foster parents. And being able to get training on how to do that and how to map what you're doing well onto this particular child who's in your home right now, and like you were saying, a group that could support you as you go through that can be essential. Two programs that we run down at the Oregon Social Learning Center, the community programs that are helpful. One is KEEP program, where we have a 16-week ongoing training. These are certified foster parents who have kids in care. They meet for 4 months at a time. They learn behaviors. They learn how to positively reinforce their kids. And then they keep coming back for 4 months to meet with the same group of foster parents to reify those skills and to move it forward. You were asking before, kind of, is a pre-service training or ongoing training? What we found is that the pre-service training looks a lot like the first day at work, where they give you the copier code and they tell you where to put your money if you buy personal stamps, and they tell you where the manila envelopes are. But then someone has to come back the next day and tell you where those things are when it's relevant to the job at hand. And that's what we find with KEEP. It's you do all the pre-service training in the world, but you have to retrain foster parents when it's relevant to this particular child. The randomized control trial data on KEEP showed that we decreased length of placement, decreased foster parent stress, increased likelihood that kids will return home, all of which is mediated by an effect on KEEP getting foster parents to be more positive about the children that are in their home right now. The program's been replicated in New York, UK, Ontario, Canada, et cetera. The other program is multidimensional treatment foster care, where we place one or two kids in the home and then wrap services around them. Again, foster parents get 24-hour, 7-day-a-week support. They meet in a foster parent group every week. And then the children get individual therapy, skills coaching, and family therapy. What we're working with right now with younger kids is a find intervention, where we actually videotape parents meeting with their kids while the kids are in care, and then are able to do parent training by showing the parents examples of them doing successfully the positive parenting skills. They become their own models. By catching them being good, using those videotape examples and feeding them back as part of the curricula, we're able to teach parents that they can be successful. Where most parent training is fairly de-skilling, saying that you don't do these things, we're able to show them examples of them doing well. And both of these examples are the kinds of interventions that 633 allows to be in place. 632 allows to be in place, where we can use empirically validated, proven treatments to come in and support foster parents in the good work that they're doing. Thank you for the chance to talk.
Thank you very much. Are there any brief questions for this panel?
Let me make a comment. And Elizabeth, I appreciate your suggestion of having foster youth involved in the designing and the evaluation of the pilots, because I've really come to appreciate the work of the Foster Youth Connection. Having foster youth come to us and advocate for themselves is good for them and it's good for us. It really helps us to understand, I think, the sort of real world situation. And unfortunately, they're often left out of the picture. And yet that's where I think we're going to get a lot of insights into the warning signs and the things that we're trying to fix. Just one other thing, and that's, you know, I know that one of the real challenges that we're facing is just getting enough foster parents, enough parents who are willing to enter the system. And, you know, in some cases, you know, I've heard complaints that there are people in the system who really should not be foster parents, but because of we don't have enough of them, and there's a crisis kind of situation, people find themselves having children placed with them. How do you address that in a pilot like this, where is there also going to be some sort of outreach to recruit more volunteers to become foster parents?
And Senator Jimbo, I'm going to ask that maybe the question be focused on the outreach that's here, and the bigger question maybe we come back to. Is that
sure?
Senator Gelser, Senator Ambrose, thank you so much. I just wanted to throw out a figure for you to kind of refer to the statement that you just made. I believe the figure that I heard in 2014 was 12,226 children in foster care. That's a lot of homes. Thank you.
And I also think that most of these empirically validated programs have a high degree of contact with the foster parents and are engaged around promoting positive development and positive behavior. My experience has been it doesn't do the vetting of the best of the foster parents. By having high degrees of contact and being able to feed that back through and stay in touch with what's going on in the home, you're able to pay attention to what the best of those folks and then retain the good people that are there, which also does a huge job in terms of keeping the numbers up.
But I think one of the key parts of the question I heard from Senator Dimbrough was would the pilot projects on the front end be putting resources into the actual recruitment of going out to find more willing families to be willing to step up and be the qualified providers? Did I hear that question the right way?
Well, obviously, the pilots can't do everything. Right. They can't answer all the questions. But that is also a key element of success, I think.
And I don't know the specifics about how much of that money goes to recruitment. I also know that when you're doing empirically validated work, when you have high retention rates, when you're supporting foster parents well, you get more foster parents coming towards you, and that works towards recruitment as well.
Thank you all very much. So our next panel is Jim Seymour and Debbie Albright, who's on the phone. We have about 10 more minutes for this bill. For those of you that are on the Right to Rest bill, we have about 26 people that are signed up. So if you might put a little bit of thought right now, I think everybody's going to have about 3 minutes to give your presentation. So maybe use the next few minutes to think about how to fit it into those 3 minutes. I wish we had more time to accommodate everyone that is here. Are we going to go with the phone first?
Madam Chair, it's at your discretion.
Let's go first to the phone, Debbie Albright, and then we'll come to you, Mr. Seymour.
Ms. Albright, are you there?
I am.
You were in front of the Senate Human Services and Early Childhood Committee on testifying on Senate Bill
632.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. My name is Debbie Albright, and I appreciate you letting me testify by phone today. The support provided by the Oregon Social Learning Center made it possible to maintain a foster placement in my home. I had a three-year-old boy who had been severely neglected and placed in the care with his baby sister. And this was one of the worst cases of neglect the intake worker had ever seen. After the children's initial shelter placement, it was decided that the children's individual needs were so high that one foster family could not care for them. So they made the decision to split them up. The baby stayed with the initial placement, and the three-year-old moved to my home. We struggled for months without services before we were finally able to get a referral to the Oregon Social Learning Center. The Oregon Social Learning Center provided 24-hour-a-day support, 7 days a week, strategies on how to care for an anxious, angry boy who would tantrum for 45 minutes to an hour and a half, 3 to 4 times per day. They also provided a skills trainer for the child, a weekly support group for me, with babysitting provided, which was key to me being able to attend that support group. And they paid for respite care when our family needed a break. We were able to maintain the sibling relationship with support from the Oregon Social Learning Center as well. The other foster mom and I became fast friends and best friends to this day, and we were able to keep the kids connected with the encouragement from OSLC. The ongoing caseworker in this case was very difficult to get a hold of or contact and very difficult to communicate with. The Oregon Social Learning Center worked with the caseworker to get things accomplished for the children and to get services for them. The Oregon Social Learning Center provided relevant practical training and facilitated visits with the parents and their children, which they incorporated helping the parents gain the skills they needed to parent their children when they returned home. These two kids did return home, and 5 years later are doing well. and I really believe this case would have had a much different outcome if the Oregon Social Learning Center had not been involved. Their program and the support they provide is priceless for foster families, for parents, and for children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Seymour.
Yes. Madam
Welcome.
Chair, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Seymour. I'm the Executive Director at Catholic Community Services. We are a state-licensed and nationally accredited foster care organization. I also serve on Harvard University Center on the Developing Child, their Frontiers of Innovation Site Council, where the mantra is building adult capability to improve child outcomes. And that has become the focus of the work there, which I think is very relevant to Senate Bill 632, which I'm here to testify in support of. Catholic Community Services provides foster care for more than 100 children on any given day. This is only about 10% of the kids in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County who are in foster care, but it's the 10% of the children with the most serious emotional and behavior problems. Ricky's one of the children we serve. He had already been in 40 different foster homes when he came to us at 10 years old. Ricky has been in his current placement now for 3 years and is doing quite well. He's even beginning to have success at school. Up until the time he came to Catholic Community Services, he had never been able to attend a public school. I'm confident that none of Ricky's prior foster parents wanted to give up on him, but without adequate training and support, he simply wore them all out. The kind of extra support we provide includes specialized trauma-informed care training, behavioral supports, ongoing child development and parent training, 24/7 on-call backup, respite care, tutoring, mentoring, and enhanced search for the foster child's healthy biological family members. Catholic Community Services provides these enhanced services, however, without any state support, and that really limits the number of foster parents we are able to provide that kind of support for. In conclusion, I'd like to encourage you to include specific measurable outcomes in this bill. The long-term outcome for all foster children should be to transition out of foster care into a nurturing, permanent home of their own, and certainly that should be the case for these children, too. But in my mind, in my experience, and I've been doing this work now for over 40 years, the two most important interim outcomes are that we have no more disrupted placements. The project has to provide a safe, stable, nurturing home for the kids to heal and to grow and develop. The second interim outcome is success at school. When kids have a home that is safe and nurturing and they feel is stable, that they're not going to be they're not going to blow out of, they can't get kicked out of, or people are not going to give up on them, then that healing begins. And when they start to enjoy success at school, those two things really do, in our experience, make them adoptable. Or oftentimes there's a family member who felt like, you know, we just couldn't deal with this child before, but now we could, and it's working. So if we can get those two things going, it really leads to the permanent placement. And thank you for the opportunity once again to testify in support of Senate Bill 632.
Thank you both so much. Are there any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much. And thank you so much for being willing to call in to join us by phone today. And we're going to hang up now. Thanks, Debbie. With that, I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 632. And I am going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 629. And as I said, I'm going to set a timer here just so that it's totally fair. And we'll do 3 minutes for each person. And the first panel is going to be Amber Dunks, Travis Smith, and Paul Bowden, please. What? I can do it on my phone. Thank you, Steve Jobs.
You can do it with your ringtone.
Yeah. Go ahead, please. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Amber Dunks. I'm a resident of Portland, Oregon, and I'm going to just come right out and say, yes, I am a houseless individual. And I'm here on behalf of Western Regional Advocacy Project, Right to Survive, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 629. There's a few things that we would like to clear up about the right to rest.
Can you come back a little bit from the microphone? Because it's really sensitive.
There's a few things I'd like to clear up about the Right to Rest Act. First of all, criminalization is not the answer to help get anybody housing and employment and help them be successful when they're homeless. The only real answer and solution to homelessness is affordable housing. But in the meantime, we do need to stop criminalizing people for performing basic acts of survival, such as sleeping and resting. Also, for sharing food in public. Praying in public should just be a right. Nobody should be discriminated against for praying in public. I'd like to go on to what this bill does not cover. This bill does not preclude private property rights. It's simply to ensure that nobody can be criminalized for carrying out basic acts of survival that are outlined in the bill. If local jurisdictions would still have the authority to enforce laws if they were littering, things like littering, aggressively panhandling, blocking a doorway or passageway, or engaging in destructive behavior. Another thing that I wanted to bring up is homeless people, the reason they're in public spaces is because they have nowhere else to go. They're just in Portland alone, there are almost 2,000 people sleeping on the streets every night, under bridges, in doorways, because there's only a few hundred shelter beds available. And most of the people out there, if they had a place to go, they would go there. They don't want to be out there. They're out there because they have no choice. Why should people who have no other place to go be discriminated against and being kept from using the same public places such as libraries and parks when nobody else gets discriminated against for that?
Your time is up.
Okay. Thank you.
Use the ringtone.
No, I think that was Law and Order ringtone.
Let's try chimes next time. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, follow that.
I can.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Travis Smith. I'm coming from Portland, Oregon, obviously, with Sisters of the Road. We are a nonprofit cafe for unhoused and impoverished folks. We have an emphasis on dining with dignity and basically giving respect to everyone who comes through our doors, which is why this bill is incredibly important to me. So basically, for most of our customers, the fear of police raids are prevalent. Most of our folks who come through our doors are on the street every night trying to find a place to be. So they have about 30 minutes in our cafe to rest and get access to a little bit of healthy food, dignity, and hospitality. But as soon as they go outside those doors, that's not available for them. When they're on the streets at night with nowhere else to go, it's possible that a police raid will stop them, take their stuff, tell them to go, and cite them. That does nothing to help with the problem. That's only creating further problems for finding housing and shelter and jobs. With that on your criminal record, it's almost impossible to get a job, as well as not having a place to shower or a place to eat or phones or access to really any of the basic human rights that most of us take for granted every day. There are also laws all across the country that prevent and criminalize sharing food and water in public spaces. We have two in Portland, but with this passing, it would be great because it would prevent more of those from passing. Food sharing programs are, for some people, the only chance they get for a healthy meal, which, as we all know, food and sleep, two of the most basic forms of survival. And the Right to Rest Act isn't telling anyone that they can sleep in doorways or obstruct public traffic or do any of that stuff. You can't be drunk in public. It's just saying that when you are doing your best to survive on the street, that's okay. No one's going to tell you to go. Because when you've had 2 hours of sleep and a police officer is waking you up telling you that you have to leave, where are you going to go? You're going to go to the next place where another police officer is going to tell you to leave. So it's basically just saying that it's okay to survive. It's legal to survive. That's it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Welcome. Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for having me. My name is Paul Bowden. I'm the director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project. And our organization was the one that the senator mentioned earlier. Our membership groups, Right to Survive, Sisters of the Road, and Street Roots are Portland organizations. I'm based out of San Francisco. I wanted to start off by saying that this bill, the same piece of legislation, has been introduced in California and has a Senate bill number in California and is being heard on April 8th in Colorado. This is a problem that was created as we talked with your staff about when we went around, so I didn't include these in the submissions. But, you know, it's very well documented that from 1979 to 1982, over $50 billion a year of affordable housing money was cut by the federal government. In 1983, we started opening shelters across the country. Cause and effect. It's very simple. And that was just the public housing. In the rural communities, these kind of cuts took another couple of years to hit. But the development of affordable housing in rural communities went from over 30,000 units a year to none, to zero. And at the same time, mortgage interest deduction programs went from $40 billion to $144 billion. So we see that there wasn't even a stopping of funding affordable housing. There was a shift in the type of housing that the federal government was willing to invest in. And that put poor people out in the streets across the United States. And the response and what we've seen in the sheet that we did send in looking just at 30 communities in Oregon, is 183 laws on the books to criminalize the presence of people for sitting, standing, sleeping, and eating. Even the people that write these laws are going to sit, stand, sleep, and eat. So are the police that enforce these laws. So how can we say that if you're in housing, you can sit, stand, sleep, and eat all you want? If you're not in housing, it is now illegal for you to sit, stand, sleep, and eat, because in all the 30 years I've been doing this work, I've not seen a whole bunch of housed people that are getting criminalized under these ordinances. They are very blatantly, very obviously, discriminatorily enforced. SRO residents get hit with them, public housing residents, day laborers. They are discriminatorily enforced against a segment of the community that local governments have decided, we're not getting the federal funding back. This needs to stop. We want this problem to go away. And the problem has been shifted onto the backs of homeless and poor people are the problem. Not the federal policies that created homelessness in the first place. Somehow that's not the problem, and we can't deal with that. We need to let go of that. It's the poor people themselves that are the problem, and if we can make them disappear, then we've addressed the issue. And that is Sundown Town. I'll end it there.
All right. Thank you very, very much. I really appreciate it. And we're not going to do questions today just so we can get through everyone that's made time to get here.
Darn. Okay.
Is that all right? All right. Next, we have Ken Newbeck, Michael Corrigan, and Dr. Wayne Martin. And while we're waiting for others to come up, why don't we go ahead and start again in the interest of making sure we can accommodate everybody today?
Okay. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak about Senate Bill 629, which addresses the criminalization of homelessness. My name is Ken Newbeck. I live in Eugene, in Lane County. I'm active with the homeless advocacy community. I volunteer with Occupy Medical and the Egan Warming Centers, and I've been on the Eugene Human Rights Commission for the past 8 years. As many as 3,000 people may be homeless in Lane County, most of whom live in the Eugene-Springfield area. And probably 75 to 80% of people who are homeless in Lane County come from Lane County. So it's not like people are coming up from California to be homeless. It's been estimated that 63% of people who were homeless in Lane County in 2013 were unsheltered. In other words, there's no shelter for two-thirds of the people who are homeless, men, women, and children. And this creates some serious problems because people who are sheltered, who are unsheltered, must conduct their life-sustaining activities in public space. So they have no other choice of where to go except public space if they want to sit, lie, eat, sleep, and even relieve themselves if there's no restroom facilities available. And in Eugene, and in many other communities, you've just heard there's 30 communities in Oregon, city ordinances and policies turn these life-sustaining activities into violations of the law, which leads to citations and fines and even arrests and going to jail. So, for example, just as an example of the policies, ordinances, in Eugene we have a no camping ordinance. It's illegal to camp any place that's not approved by the city government. Even sitting on the sidewalk with a bedroll next to you, you can be cited for camping, even though you're not really camping, you just happen to have the camping stuff with you. We also have a car camping ordinance. People cannot sleep in their cars unless they're sleeping in a number of designated places that are overseen by St. Vinny's. But other than that, you must move or you will be cited. And then there's the question of where do you actually move to. The criminalization of homelessness has many negative consequences, not only for people who are unhoused, but for the community as a whole. The approach is ineffective in that it doesn't reduce homelessness. Rather, it increases the sense of marginalization, the anxieties, the depression of those who are unhoused. There's a lot of mental health problems amongst people who are unhoused, not because they became unhoused because they had mental health problems, but they have mental health problems because they're unhoused. Secondly, it's an expensive misuse of the time and training of members of the police department, who taxpayers expect to be out preventing and solving serious crimes. And many of the officers I've spoken to in Eugene do not like enforcing these laws and treating people who are homeless as law violators. Criminalization.
Can you wrap up?
Okay.
She said wrap up.
Oh, wrap up. Three things. I'm wrapping right here at the end.
Wrapping quickly.
Okay. Criminalization of homelessness is ineffective, expensive, and harms people who are homeless. And SB 629, in outlawing criminalization, encourages local communities to become highly proactive in finding ways to address homelessness that are, one, effective in reducing it, two, less costly than a law enforcement approach, three, helps rather than harms those who are unhoused, and four, benefits the entire community.
Very, very much. Welcome.
My name is Michael Kerrigan. I'm the Program Director for Community Alliance of Lane County in Eugene, or CALC. We advocate for homeless rights and for increased funding for programs which benefit the homeless in Lane County. Senator Gelser, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the chance to speak today. I'm a founding board member of Opportunity Village Eugene, a highly successful homeless village of Conestoga huts and small bungalows in West Eugene, and also a founder of the Nightingale Health Sanctuary, a 30-person rest stop for the homeless on Lane County land in Eugene. All these efforts are privately funded and are in addition to the existing programs run by St. Vincent de Paul and other organizations in Eugene and Springfield. New and innovative things are happening in Lane County. There's a wonderful collaboration between activists, social service providers, local governments, and the unhoused. But we're just scratching the surface. The need is so great. In 2013 and 15...
Pull your head a little bit away from the microphone. Very good.
All right. CAL coordinated the out-in-the-field part of the one-night homeless count in Lane County. In 2013, we counted 1,769 unsheltered people in all kinds of places. But we know this is an undercount because over 9,000 individuals who were homeless in 2013 sought social services through the Lane County Human Service Commission. In Eugene and Springfield, hundreds of people every night face arrests for sleeping. And as a human rights organization, we feel this should stop. Citations and jail time only worsen the condition of people without homes and limit their opportunities to escape homelessness. The passage of the REST Act will encourage more humane and effective responses to homelessness and will encourage the diversion of expenditures on citing and jailing people for resting in public spaces to efforts to prevent and end homelessness. There are what we call frequent flyers in Eugene arrested for camping who have cost the city hundreds of thousands of dollars in court and jail costs. We would much rather see funds allocated for a wet bed center or other housing where these folks could safely live. And when homeless people are arrested or even incarcerated just for being too poor to pay for these tickets or for sleeping, a criminal record creates barriers to housing and employment. We have a wonderful young man living in a tent in the backyard at Calc who desperately wants to find housing but cannot because he has an arrest record. Yes, I took part in the Housing Alliance Lobby Day with dozens of people from around the state, you know, calling for increased funding for programs. Very inspiring day. They are also calling for supporting the right to rest. And if Senate Bill 629 passes and goes to an effect, chaos will not result. All these people who were here yesterday and many others around the state will roll up their sleeves to make those laws work for all concerned and to end homelessness in Oregon. Let's send a message to the rest of the country that Oregon is a human rights state where everybody is treated with dignity and respect. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Wayne Martin. I live in Eugene. I'm in Paul Holvey's ward, our district, and my senators are Senator Prozansky and Senator Edwards. I'm a retired congregational minister and a retired medical and hospice chaplain. I'm also a former Navy lieutenant in the field of underwater explosive ordnance disposal. I was critically injured on a dive related mishap due to faulty equipment and spent 8 months in rehabilitation, and then opted to return to my work as an EOD officer and serve two tours in Southeast Asia. My decision to pursue my career to applied spirituality was dependent entirely upon my time in what I saw and what I learned during my time in the military and in combat. Simply put, I learned firsthand that the necessity to recover from significant trauma of any kind is nearly impossible without more than adequate resources. I was blessed with more than adequate resources, but some of my comrades in the military were not. I meet many of them on the street. I also meet many who were not veterans, who are also recovering from trauma. They include exposure to drugs and alcohol. They include exposure to bullying and gang activity as children. They include mild to severe mental illness and are inadequately treated, if treated at all. They include autism. They include those who cannot maintain significant relationships, and they include economic trauma. Loss of jobs, inadequate retraining, loss of house or apartment, loss of the capacity to support their children. So my training as a hospice chaplain is highly relevant to caring for those who have been traumatized by what I mentioned above. In closing, you are public servants, and I thank you. Perhaps you are public servants because you have that same sensitivity to human and social need that true public service requires. SB 629 asks you for that sensitivity. The traumatized in our society need your compassion. They are also entitled to basic human and constitutional rights. SB 629 grants some of those rights, including the right to rest without being arrested or cited or disturbed. One last thing. You are public servants again, and I thank you. I feel you will pass SB 629. I plead with you to work with your colleagues in the House to exercise their sensitivity and innate charity toward those who deserve a place to rest. Pass the bill, work with your colleagues, and celebrate. It really won't cost a dime.
Thank you all very much. So next up we have Grant Swanson, Todd Kiger, and Desiree Hilligers. And on deck we'll have Sharon Canova, Michael Salvaggio, and Lloyd Hinion. Please go ahead and start.
Hello. Thank you, Madam Chair and other senators, for this time. My name for the record is Grant Swanson. I am here representing both AFSCME Local 88 and Right to Dream 2. I am the treasurer of Right to Dream 2 and on the e-board of my local. Our local unanimously passed support of this Right to Rest Act, and we also brought it to our council, so the statewide council has also endorsed this. And my experience with houselessness has been varied. When I was really young, I spent a summer living on the streets of Chicago, and I learned firsthand what it was like to be treated differently than I had been in my upbringing of in Michigan. And then I moved out here to the West Coast 15 years ago or so, to the Portland area, where I worked with homeless youth in shelters in Portland, where I learned firsthand some of the challenges facing folks here in Oregon. And then through my work with my local, and then later, through the work of Right to Survive and Right to Dream 2, I became more intimately involved with the challenges that folks face. And our union supports human rights and have supported this bill. And I feel that it is important that people take the time to talk to and understand the challenges facing people without homes. I think that there are a lot of misnomers and disinformation out there about people who are unhoused. And, for example, a lot of these ordinances that other folks have spoken about in municipalities across the state speak to this assumption that where there are homeless people or where there are houseless individuals, there is crime. And that is just not the case. Statistics have borne out the fact that unhoused people are just that. They're unhoused. The only thing that makes them get criminal records are laws that make survival behaviors illegal. And yes, these populations deal with many other challenges at a higher percentage than housed folks, such as addiction, such as mental health issues. But really, they're just like everyone else. And I know time is precious, so I will end it there. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Todd Kieser. And I won't add too much more to this because you're hearing a lot of the same things today. But, you know, one thing I would like to point out is just the criminalization of homelessness really becomes institutionalized or society-approved discrimination. And in our society, whenever we've seen institutionalized discrimination, you see more violence against that group. And that's what you see today, is the homeless are targeted for more violence than other groups of people. And passing this would be a step towards not approving discrimination against the homeless, and I think it would be a great step or signal to everybody that violence against the homeless isn't okay. We just need to allow them to live their life while they're doing their life-sustaining needs. I would also ask the people who might vote against this is, you know, we have all these laws on the books. Have they solved any problems? Are they really fit the morals that you want for your society, or can we do better? And I think what we see is the result of these laws are creating more problems than they're solving, and they're also costing the state more money and the municipalities more money that by doing this. So I would say this doesn't cost us anything. In fact, it's going to save all the municipalities more save money for everybody, because there's better ways of treating the homeless. I too was here yesterday walking in the halls, and I couldn't help but notice as I walked past your office, Senator Gelzer, you had a sign out there with a quote that said, "People, even more than things, have to be restored, renewed, revived, reclaimed, and redeemed. Never throw out anyone." And I think SB 629 is a step toward reclaiming lives of those who are homeless rather than throwing them out.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Desiree Hilligers, and I'm an associate professor of English at Washington State University, Vancouver, where I was also a founding co-director of the Center for Social and Environmental Justice. I spent a couple of years working with homeless women in shelters in Seattle in the 1980s, and I wrote a book that was published in 2011 with Palgrave Macmillan that was a book-length oral history based on interviews I conducted with women struggling through homelessness. The majority of the women that I interviewed suffered from a whole host of debilitating health issues, including fibromyalgia, arthritis, high blood pressure, and sickle cell anemia. I didn't deliberately seek out women with health issues to interview, but anyone who spent time in drop-in centers, shelters, or tent cities could speak to the pervasiveness of major health issues among unhoused people. One woman in her late 40s who'd recently had brain surgery told a story about suffering a stroke, getting off a bus, and walking up a hill to a drop-in center for houseless and low-income women. My leg felt heavy, so I caught the bus, and I got up, and I walked up that hill. Then I just got to the point where I couldn't use my leg at all, and I had to drag it, so I dragged it up that hill. And she goes on with the story, and she says, "It never dawned on me that I was having a stroke. But in fact, it wasn't actually that surprising, but because she'd already had one stroke and had only recently had brain surgery and was unable to get the Plavix that she needed to prevent the onset of another stroke. The staff at the center had to just about restrain her in order to get her into an ambulance because, as she told me, go figure, with all the luck that day of my stroke, I had a housing appointment. And what do you pick, go to the hospital or go to a housing appointment? I don't know. You just hope for the best." Within a year of my last interview with her, she died at a nursing home at about the age of 50 and of a stroke, not of a stroke, but of ovarian cancer that had gone undiagnosed during her long struggle with houselessness. My interviews were conducted with women in Seattle, but their experiences are not distinct from people confronting houselessness in Portland. For more than a decade now, Seattle King County has been tracking the deaths of homeless people on the streets of one of the most livable cities in the United States. Portland only began this tracking about 3 years ago, and estimates that at least 50 people are dying on the streets of Portland or Multnomah County every year, and that means about a person is dying a week on the streets of Portland or Multnomah County. But more and more people are suffering through homelessness with major debilitating life-threatening conditions. During one night count of the homeless several years ago, I spoke with a veteran in his 50s who was sleeping under an overpass close to Emmanuel Hospital, where he was passing kidney stones during the day and was just in absolute intense pain. In December, a dear friend of mine, Deborah Hill, died thankfully inside with hospice care, but she'd spent upwards of two decades homeless in Portland. Deborah, I learned when she came to live with my spouse and I for about a year, had been born with a host of congenital health issues. She'd spent her childhood in and out of Shriners Children's Hospital, struggling through painful surgeries, and she had the scars to prove it. But when she came of age and couldn't hold down her job as a CNA any longer, she ended up living on the streets. How she survived for so long, I will never know. But she told me one night about sleeping out in the snow and having a police officer wake her, make her get up and walk, and that's what this profoundly disabled woman did. One night when she was living with us, she told me she couldn't come in that night, and when I asked why, she told me that there was a 70-year-old woman with no shoes on sleeping under the bridge, and she couldn't sleep out there alone. And I ask you, who are we as a society that we are debating whether or not people who are homeless and exhausted, many of whom are profoundly disabled, have a right to sit down or rest? Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Right, next we have Sharon Canopa and Michael Savaggio. And Lloyd, you don't want to come up, correct? All right. And then on deck we have Rob Sis, Sabra Marcroft, and Barry Jo Stoll. Thank you. Mayor Canopa.
Okay. Thank you, Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood, and Chair Senator Sarah Gelsler. My name is Sharon Canopa. I'm the mayor of Albany, and I have been a member of the Albany City Council for over 18 years. You rarely see me here in front of you, yet I live only a half hour away from the Capitol, But when there's an issue that affects my hometown and my past homeless advocacy efforts, I need to come express my concern. On your dais, you should have a letter from the City of Albany. It's the Albany City Council opposes this bill, and also our Albany Police Department. I do have a representative here from the city. Lieutenant Casey Dorland is from the Albany Police Department, in case you have any questions over the concerns that are addressed in that letter. In my experience, though, in Albany with social service programs, Senate Bill 629 would enable homeless individuals to continue their lifestyle and would be a hindrance to move them towards self-sufficiency and into housing. I have advocated strongly for the past 10 years to have programs and social service agencies collaborate to reduce the number of homeless persons. Former Governor Ted Kulongowski encouraged Oregon counties to establish 10-year plans to address homelessness, and Albany followed that lead. If you are thinking, oh, this lady just doesn't want any homeless people in her town, you do not know me personally. In 2006, Albany shut down a homeless camp that had been in place on city property for 40 years. I took it upon myself to help these homeless campers by driving them in my car to get clean and presentable in order to seek jobs and housing. I learned a lot about the lifestyle of a homeless person during this time and what layers it takes for them to try to become self-sufficient. I had to convince several persons to turn themselves into law enforcement as they had pending warrants. They trusted me and allowed me to take them to the county jail. Many people experiencing homelessness just need some support and guidance in life. In 2008, I co-chaired Linn County's 10-year homeless plan committee and continue to be on the homeless plan oversight committee. Albany also coordinated with Benton County's homeless plan, since Albany is the second largest city in Benton County. Our community strives to make sure that agency and program services don't overlap so our limited resources can be more effective. Albany's goal is to get people into housing and to not maintain their lifestyle of homelessness. We want to be truly of service to the homeless by putting a roof over their heads. But it can be extremely challenging to get a person who is homeless to accept a social service program. This Senate bill would be a huge hindrance to many homeless advocates' efforts to help someone move towards housing. An example, in Albany at the former camp I mentioned, some people had lived there for 15 years. Why should they seek a job in housing when their lifestyle is allowed in public places? A person who is homeless has a full-time job just to maintain that homeless lifestyle. Every citizen should have a dwelling, a real dwelling. That should be the number one focus, and I would hope our state's goal. Can anyone conscientiously believe this bill would benefit a homeless person? Why would anyone want to encourage someone to live outdoors, some of them with pets, and subject them to the weather? Does anyone believe they are not causing harm to this person if this bill moves forward? Please support homeless individuals by supporting social service agencies' programs that truly help the homeless. By voting no on this bill, you will be helping the homeless. So thank you for listening.
Thank you, Mayor.
Mm-hmm. Chair Gelson, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio speaking on behalf of the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. We recognize and appreciate the challenges that persons experiencing homelessness face every single day. A lot of my members see that on a face-to-face basis. The challenges are not trivial. Persons experiencing homelessness deserve the same dignity as everyone else. Senate Bill 629 proposes to create allowances for these persons to rest, walk, eat, generally utilize public spaces. In order to satisfy that goal, the state, through Senate Bill 629, seeks to supersede any conflicting local ordinances. The decision to supersede a local ordinance in order to establish consistent state policy is not uncommon. And frankly, if the bill had stopped there, I believe ORCOPS would have remained neutral and been pleased to leave this to the legislature's discretion. We do not oppose the underlying concept of this bill. However, Senate Bill 629 creates some troubling potential conflicts in how it is worded right now. I know that Senator Shields' office brought up the fact that there are Dash 2 amendments in existence. We have not had a chance to vet those, so I'm afraid I cannot speak to those at this time. But I'm very encouraged that he seemed willing to continue to work to perfect this this concept. But generally to put the existing concern on the record. Establishing certain rights for persons experiencing homelessness creates an ambiguous situation where public safety officers may be expected to enforce local ordinances differently for persons based on their homelessness status. And if their assessment of that status is an error, they are then subjected to a special litigative process that is unique to the enforcement of 629. So the bill creates disparities both in terms of the application of ordinances to individuals based on their status and also in terms of the resulting litigative process. We are concerned about the difficulty of enforcement as well as the precedent with regard to the enforcement of local ordinances. So as a result, we cannot support Senate Bill 629 as it's currently drafted. If the legislature wishes to supersede local ordinances to allow individuals the dignity in order to rest, walk, eat, and otherwise utilize public spaces in a uniform manner, that's within the legislature's ability. If that effort is simply undertaken overtly on an equal footing among all residents and among all ordinances without special litigative processes that specifically target law enforcement officers, we would likely move to a neutral stance.
Thank you both very much.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it. So next up we have Rob Siss, Sabra Marcroft, and Barry Jo Stoll. And on deck after that we have Vicki Walsay, David Strahan, and Oris Badik. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Rob Siss, president of SEIU 503 OPEU, and we represent 55,000 workers throughout the state in a variety of sectors and a diversity of income levels, but a great many are still low-wage earners, and of those, a number struggle to maintain the basic needs of life for themselves and their families. Also, a great number of our members work in various aspects of social services with houseless individuals, couples, and families. They have seen the cuts to services that affected these populations after well over a decade of dwindling funding for these services. They have also seen dramatic increases of those depending on these services as economic conditions for many Oregonians have deteriorated. Whole programs have been cut, and other vital programs serving these economically disadvantaged have been dramatically underfunded, leaving these Oregonians who are on the edge or fallen off in increasingly dire straits. While an alarming number of Oregonians have been struggling to make ends meet with less and less support, housing and basic need costs have gone up, while incomes of those struggling have either gone down or disappeared. More and more people have been forced onto the streets, creating an even more formidable obstacle for those on the bottom from getting back on their feet, as well as dealing them severe physical, emotional, and psychological trauma. As the homeless situation has continued to grow worse over time, these people are being criminalized for just trying to survive in a society that has left them out in the cold. We have seen the injustice of laws such as Portland's sit-lie ordinance or the sidewalk management plans put forth by the Portland Business Alliance and the City of Portland. The criminalization of the poor must end. Along with critical elements of the Fair Shot for All campaign, we and our allies are championed so Oregonians on the low end can get ahead. We believe anything that provides them the moral support they so desperately need in their daily lives to survive with hope and ultimately improve their welfare is an incredibly noble and worthy cause. We applaud this bill as a vital, compassionate, and basic step in extending a hand up to those on the bottom.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to speak here. My name is Sabra Marcroft. I live in Eugene, in Lane County. And I've been homeless once. About 23 years ago, my two small children, my husband and I, were homeless for a brief period of time. We are one of the success stories of the safety net that we used to have. We received the help we needed to keep our time homeless very brief. And our family has been very successful since then. My son is 27 years old, a college graduate, and gainfully employed. My daughter is also employed and the mother of my granddaughter, who was born a month ago yesterday.
Congratulations. What's her name?
My granddaughter's name is Sophia Bonita.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Now, that safety net that helped my family pretty much doesn't exist anymore. Waiting lists in Eugene, for example, for permanent supportive housing, which is not what we would have been eligible for, but waiting lists for permanent supportive housing are 2 to 3 years long. That means for people who are severely mentally ill, if they are able to jump through the hoops and survive long enough, they might get a home in 2 to 3 years. That basically makes it a death sentence. Even if this new federal push for housing first is completely successful, it's going to take time. We simply don't have the housing stocks. We don't have the supportive organizations with enough staffing to help people get back into housing, to stay in housing they already are in. We don't have it yet. So it's going to take a few years, even if this new federal push lasts. So since this is going to take years, those years represent continued tragedy and deaths for people who are unhoused or become so. I helped start Opportunity Village, a transitional micro-housing community for 30-plus people. I helped to create the Rest Stop program in Eugene, and I'm on the steering committee for Nightingale Health Sanctuary. Together, we as a community in Eugene have created new shelter and transitional housing for over 300 people in the last 3 years with no government funding. That's amazing, but we will never come close to meeting the need at this rate.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. I'll start by removing my hat. I'm a person with a disability. I have a very difficult to manage neurological condition as a result of a spinal cord injury from a car accident and the passage of time.
And if you need your hat, that's fine.
No, that's fine. Okay. I'm Thank you. My problem. Oh,
and
Barry,
your name.
My name is Barry Jo Stahl. I'm sorry, and I will be submitting some material via Ms. Hernandez over there. Take a minute here and let us all just breathe. I became homeless on two occasions. First occasion is best exemplified by my Supreme Court case. I prosecuted it myself. It's Stahl versus Hoke. Mary Hoke was a landlord. She lied and she cheated and she stole. I fought a case. So she's memorialized in that Supreme Court case. More recently, I became homeless when my nonprofit affordable housing landlord filed a 30-day no-cause eviction, 2005, and I appealed it, only to endure the process of being locked out in violation of a stay pending appeal and the landlord destroying over $20,000 of my property on two distinct occasions. That landlord was testifying yesterday as one of the affordable housing providers, and I'm incensed at the fiveplex, including the apartment that I was evicted from. It's been vacant for 3 years in the city of Portland. So we were out in front with our chants and our signs to say house keys, not handcuffs. Believe me, folks, every member of this committee could be living in that vacant apartment complex that's in Portland right now. We have folks here that need housing. So we have put, as I learned from the teacher at Portland Community College, it's their lobby day today. I got an award from Governor Kitzhaber after I graduated from PCC with highest honors. So I've got some history with them. But I took a class from Warren Cook, who was citing the now mothballed Wapato jail we put about $50 million into. He said, if you want to know, we don't have a justice system, we have an injustice system. You'd like to know more about that, I recommend a book. He said, the rich get richer and the poor get prison. Well, I'm proof of that. We had an action in front of City Hall to protest a ban on camping. There's provisions in Oregon law that cities can have designated campgrounds. There's a mandate that there is an anti-camping ordinance under ORS 203, 081 is the permitted campground approach. But they're not paying much attention to that. Instead, it's easier to put people like me in jail again and again and again. I filed a federal case because the sidewalk management ordinance was passed in the city of Portland in violation of the city charter. They didn't have a quorum. They took a vote over the telephone, and I sued in federal court. And I was arrested October, November, December, February, July 14th, July 17th, July 17th, July 19th, and July 19th of 2012, starting in 2011. I have my keys right now because I sued a social service agency in federal court for violating the Fair Housing Act. I'm housed because I have a HUD grant. Not everybody has the resources to champion and endure these things as I do. So please, I'm going to wrap up with one point that I think you should all understand. When we passed the Death with Dignity Act that legalized assisted suicide, that resulted in an intense effort to have pain management so people with conditions like myself didn't elect to commit suicide. So by passing these laws, we actually change the environment. We make other people respond to those situations rather than ignore them. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Next up, we have Vicki Welsey, David Strahan, and Grace Baddick. And on deck, we have Scott Winkles and Marion Haynes. Welcome. And to Grace, I apologize that my handwriting is so bad that the G looked like an O.
That's okay. My name is Grace Baddick, and I work at Street Roots, the street newspaper in Portland. And Street Roots has been working with people experiencing homelessness and poverty for more than 15 years. Mm-hmm. And during that time, we've seen the detrimental impact of laws that target people on the streets. The criminalization of homelessness perpetuates homelessness by creating legal barriers to housing and employment, and we often work with those folks who are affected by that. Being able to lay down and rest, sitting and standing, and being able to walk freely are all things that are fundamental to the human experience. We believe people experiencing homelessness have not only the right to rest, but to shelter and housing. This bill is ultimately about housing and the lack of affordable housing in Oregon. Yesterday, I was here with the Oregon Housing Alliance for the Housing Opportunity Day, advocating for more funding for homeless services and housing. But until we make housing a priority and allocate the necessary funds to prevent and end homelessness, we cannot criminalize people for trying to do what we all need to do to survive. The way to reduce the number of people who are sleeping and living outside is not to criminalize their efforts to exist in public space, but rather to make shelters, day centers, services, and most especially housing available to all those who need it. We believe this bill is one step in being able to give people experiencing homelessness and poverty a chance to be successful in life. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Senator Gelser, other senators. I'm Vicki Nelson from Eugene, and I'm an advocate for the homeless, and I work for the Nightingale Health Sanctuary there. Eugene, like many cities and towns in Oregon, is abloom with no trespassing and no camping signs. These represent an attempt by the city to close down traditional places where homeless people sleep, nooks under bridges, riverside hidey holes, and abandoned property. So if the city does not want the homeless to sleep there, where Eugene Police Department just put the no camping signs, where exactly do they want the homeless to sleep? Strange how that question never gets answered, except by a vague sense of somewhere else, possibly somewhere near Springfield or up near Junction City, somewhere where the unhoused will not be our problem. But in reality, there is nowhere else. All the towns and cities in Oregon are dealing with homeless problems. All the powers that be wish the homeless were somewhere else. The problem is that somewhere else is likely to be a city in Oregon that is right now putting up the no trespassing, no camping signs. The cops get the terrible job of rousting the homeless from their sleep and telling them to move on. Most people in this room have probably experienced sleep deprivation at some time. Maybe you've been a new parent, maybe a new PhD, a new MD going through residency, or a student who has pulled one too many all-nighters. But this kind of sleep deprivation will go away, and what's more, it has a built-in reward: having a little kid, being a doctor, getting your college degree. What if every single night when you lay down, you had to worry that you would be rudely awakened, that your possessions might be stolen, and that you would end up in jail? What if you were already mentally or physically fragile, had PTSD, as many of our veterans do, were maybe addicted to alcohol or drugs, or on the edge of a nervous breakdown? Sleep deprivation could push you over the edge, and it does push many homeless people over the edge, making them a danger to themselves, to others, and creating a much worse public safety situation than if a few people that are just sleeping under a bridge somewhere. Countless magazine, newspaper, and scholarly articles tell us that sleep deprivation is bad for our bodies and our minds. It can lead to high blood pressure, diabetes, irritability, and hallucinations. It can even kill us. It is used as a form of torture in the enhanced interrogations of our enemies. I'm here to ask the Oregon legislature to support Senate Bill 629. Let's decide at the state level to become a more humane society here in Oregon and end the criminalization of homelessness.
Thank you so much. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Chair and Senators. Appreciate the time to speak today. My name is David Strahan. I live south of here. I'm a resident of Lane County, and I've been an outspoken advocate for the homeless and the unsheltered for a long time. I want to talk to you today about saving money and stop wasting money on the inhumane treatment that's currently facing our unhoused people. Currently in our system, when a person gets ticketed for sleeping illegally or a criminal trespass, which is often handed out in the same time, they start a legal spiral that can affect their ability to get a job, to get housing, medical care, sometimes even food. When a person gets the citation through no fault of his own for the simple act of falling asleep somewhere where a popo says he's not supposed to be, it starts a process with a ticket being issued, which obviously that person probably doesn't have the funds to pay. When they lose their ticket or they miss their court date, that person ends up with a warrant. So the next time that person has an interaction with the police, regardless of where they're at, they're automatically arrested. Their survival gear is confiscated. Their sleeping bags, their backpack, their food, their personal belongings, and their medications are often confiscated because they're arrested. Once they're released, they have to come back upon the social agencies who have come out to help them for that help again to get their survival gear back. They have to regain that sleeping bag. They have to regain that spot where they had a safe place to sleep, a safe place to winter. And sometimes they don't get their survival gear back. Sometimes they don't make it. I've found them. I know what happens when they don't make it through a winter. It's not nice. We've heard Albany talk about how they don't want to support this bill. Albany in this list has the second highest number of laws against homelessness in the entire state. I'm sorry, I don't stand on there. I support Senate Bill 629. I think it's reasonable to assume that people are going to sleep and to ticket the people who have the inability to pay and further put them deeper in despair is the wrong way to treat our homelessness. We need to start approving single room occupancies. We need to look at alternative forms of housing. We need to stop giving away our tax breaks to out-of-state developers who take the money and run without building truly affordable housing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
This is Keegan. He's a little 12-year-old kid with terminal brain cancer who understands homelessness. He walked to Salem to speak on behalf of the homelessness here.
Is he here?
He's not here today.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much. Next, we have Scott Winkles and I cannot read my handwriting, Marion Haynes.
And on deck, we have Tracy Jocelyn, Ken Laney, and Brad Gibson. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. League of Oregon Cities is a organization of all 242 incorporated cities in the state of Oregon. I would like to say, for the record, that we're approaching this issue with as much compassion and sensitivity as we can, but we do have concerns about the language in the bill. First off, I would point out that the first thing that jumped out at me when I was doing my analysis on this legislation was Section 5B, Sub B, where we civil and human rights that are protected for persons in their homes and other private places be extended to the public spaces in which the person is experiencing homelessness. That list of rights is fairly inclusive, and it would also include things like, in my reading interpretation, the Castle Doctrine. So a person, Oregon is a duty to retreat state, meaning if you're feeling a threat and you're in open space, you have a duty to, if you can safely do so, retreat. You don't have a duty to retreat in your own home. That is my understanding of the Castle Doctrine. Applying that doctrine to a public space, I think, could be problematic, and I don't know if that was the intent of the sponsors or the intent of the committee. That would give us grave concern. Additionally, if a city were to have a no camping ordinance or an area where it was parked closed after, say, 30 minutes after dusk, which is fairly common, you can't ask someone to leave their require someone to leave their home in the state of Oregon without talking to a judge. And so, do you have to go to through an eviction process if a person is using staying on that piece of property in that park in that public space? Do you have to go through that process, an eviction process, even though they're not allowed to stay in there? Could you? I don't know if that was the intent, but that is my reading of this legislation. Additionally, the definition of harassment is fairly broad. Harassment means knowing or willfully course of conduct by law enforcement security. One of the things in there is to annoy someone. So if a police officer does a welfare check on a person, or a fire department does a welfare check on a person, and they wish to determine if the person is medically stable and medically sound, and they wake that person up, have they annoyed them? Have they exposed? Is there a liability attached to it? So if a public official is in the lawful course of their duties and their responsibilities, exercising those duties, is there an affirmative defense? Is there do we intend to create a liability for someone who's simply doing a welfare check, or is enforcing an ordinance, a no camping ordinance? I don't know. I don't know if that was the intent. With that, I would simply say that we do support the proposed $100 million bonding package that for low-income housing, and would point out that we are still working to get through inclusionary zoning through this legislature to ensure more affordable housing in the state.
Thank you very much. Marion, welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Marion Haynes. I am with the Portland Business Alliance. We represent about 1,800 businesses in the Portland metro area, and we also run the Downtown Clean and Safe program, which is the business improvement district funded by property owners in downtown Portland. Homelessness is an issue in Portland, and we realize that, but we do not believe that Senate Bill 629 is the solution to that problem. We believe instead we should be increasing shelters, transitional housing, and services so that there are options other than public streets and parks for people experiencing homelessness. And we advocate regularly and work with City Council to try to move some of those issues forward. It's not safe living on the streets. In Portland, we have seen an uptick in homeless persons being victimized and subjected to crimes more and more that's happening within that community itself. And this is particularly true for women and other vulnerable populations. We have a concern that this bill basically tells law enforcement, security, and local government officials to take a hands-off approach. But in our experience, it is some of the interactions that are allowed in doing welfare checks and things of that nature that provide that opportunity to discuss available services and things like that with these populations. Just this past summer, the Portland Police instituted a new program, a walking beat program that really internalized a social service model of outreach to folks experiencing homelessness, and it's been widely recognized as successful by both the business community and a number of social service agencies like Janus Youth that regularly work with homeless youth populations on the streets. That's the kind of thing that we think we should be pursuing in order to address this issue. We try to do our part as well. The Alliance, through its Clean and Safe program, has provided funding for storage and emergency shelters and showers to serve this community. We've provided gap funding to Janus Youth when a glitch in administration, they lost their federal funding to do outreach for folks on the street, so we provided gap funding so that there wasn't any gap in those services. We work with transition projects to hire formerly homeless individuals to do outreach on the street, and we're able to get a number of those folks into shelters and into services. We believe that we should be providing more services and support and not just enabling the kind of situation that exists right now. We shouldn't be allowing people to be victimized, be subject to these kinds of conditions. And from our point of view, we think we can and should strive to do better.
Thank you both very much. Next up, we have Tracy Jocelyn, Ken Laney, and Brad Gibson. And on deck, we have Terry Light, P-T-E-R-Y, and Monica Beeman. Welcome.
Me first.
Sure.
Hi, my name is... I'm loud. My name is Tracy Jocelyn. Thank you for hearing us today. I have resided in Eugene for 30 years. I have worked hard and raised a son on a low income as a single parent. My son now lives in North Portland with a partner and their new baby girl, Quinn Orla.
Beautiful. Congratulations.
They're doing well. I will let him know he has an advocate for his mom in the Senate. I have been without stable housing for 7 years, pretty much because rent is just too much for me. I have lived in my van on the streets and now in community at Nightingale Health Sanctuary Rest Stop on county land in Eugene. I have
been
an advocate.
Can you push the microphone back just a little bit? It's a little close. Thank you.
I have been an advocate for people without houses for over 20 years. I stand for their dignity, kindness, talents, and beautiful caring spirits. Besides the challenges of surviving day to day is the reality of how people without houses are viewed and treated, like they are problems and non-contributors. I'm currently paying off 3 illegal camping tickets through Road Crew. I have driven around for hours trying to find a safe place to park. Most often the good spots have huge spotlights to deter me from resting there. I have been told to move along by people who know me and by people who don't. Every person has value. Every person is someone's child. If you treat someone with the human dignity they deserve, the outcome is a participating member of society. Please support the Oregon Right to Rest Act so that people without houses have the opportunity to find a place where they are safe to sleep instead of removed, alone, and unsafe. It is just one step to allowing people to have somewhere to sleep so they can make decisions and move their life forward instead of staying stuck. Safe sleep is a human right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Ken Laney. I am currently homeless. It's a temporary situation, I hope. I'm out looking every day, filling out usually 5 or 6 applications a week. I was made homeless due to a fire. It's not a something that I have. I'm not an addict. I'm not an alcoholic. And I'm just here as a voter. I'm just here as me. Talk to you guys. I'm really impressed. This is great. I talked to the city council one time, and now I'm talking to senators of the state. Yeah, this is really cool. And it just seems to me I'd like you to not let this die in committee. That's all I want to say. Give my senator that I voted for, who made it in, hey, the opportunity to pass a no-brainer. Not asking you to let them camp or asking you to let them sleep. Wild dogs need to sleep at night. Let's let the people. That's it.
Thank you very much. Are you a veteran, too?
No, ma'am. This is just looks good on me.
Very good on you.
Hi, my name's Brad. My name is Brad Gibson, and I'm from Portland, and I'm the vice chair for Right to Dream 2, which is a homeless rest area. Okay, the reason we had to build this rest area was because people were being criminalized out on the street. We see it every day, every night. People being, you know, this sleep deprivation is a very hazardous thing to go through. And so we built a rest area so that people could get a good night's sleep. Now, all this, you know, the Portland Police Department has went so far as to hire other private security agencies. Now, municipalities are not handling this very well. So, if you pass this law into law, it might help them take a better look at themselves if you take that criminalization tool out of their toolbox. It will help them deal with it better, you know, come up with other standards of dealing with the problem. That's all I got to say.
Thank you very, very much. All right, and we have Terry Light and Monica Beamer. I can't read my handwriting.
Beamer.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you, Chair and Senator Committees. My name is Terry Light. I'm from North Portland and live in the Coley District. I'm formerly homeless in Portland. When I first arrived in Portland, I had been coming off camping out in the wilderness for long periods of time because a lot of times the cities are not safe. I intend to harm no one, so I try and stay safe, and I am camping out in the bush. I stayed at Digny Village. That was the one place, the shelter, what was appropriate for me because there was no bathrooms that were safe for me. I have a particular history that doesn't allow me to be in that communal space. Yes, I'm a transgender queer person and homeless here in Portland. So I was able to work with other people together and help to make that people safe, people at Digny Village. I offered my services and helped organize there. I'm one of the help founders of R2D2, making more space. The ability for human beings to collectively organize themselves is astounding. I think it was somebody who told me that the nation of Australia was founded by criminals who were kicked out of other places. And it's a great nation today. R2D2 are a group of people. There's some really beautiful people. I've witnessed lots and lots of humanity there. People taking care of each other, you know, and dealing with the same thing the social services are dealing with, the frustration, getting yelled at, you know, you're not enough. We hear that all the time at the rest area. There's not enough. Our founder here has been assaulted a couple times by people because they're angry about the rest area not enough and the social service not enough. And I'm grateful to be an American and be here and know there's enough food and that I have shelter every night. And now that I have had a job for the last 2 years, I work in a healing organization where people massage each other and take time to relax and rest. And a profoundly understanding of the lack of rest, it makes no sense to me to criminalize people for doing what they need to do. Without sleep, you cannot think. If you go for more than 3 days without sleep, and you're going to hallucinate. I don't care who you are. I don't know how well sane you are. You will go hallucinate. And how we don't have so much more violent homeless people, I don't know why we don't. These are some very compassionate people. They're very aware of all the suffering around them. The people in housing have no clue. people in housing. They forget that they use the bathroom all the time. They forget that they have a shower. They forget that they have ability to cook their food. Criminalizing is punishing what that cannot be done otherwise. It makes no sense. And I say it's not the answer, but it's also the idea that until you know what to do, do no harm. That is a lie in medicine. At first, do no harm. To criminalize homeless people is to violate that sense of being a human being, of being an opportunity for heal. If you don't know what to do, let nature do something. And I saw yes in all the places that are saying yes, social services, they need to get their butt out on the street and start talking to people on the street because that's where they are. I'm sorry, I raised my voice. You guys are here to help serve, so I'm thank you.
Thank
and
you
also,
very much.
Plug and plug there. Please support people. Support the training for foster parents. I am a former foster parent. And yes, it takes a lot of struggle and a lot to learn. It's a huge thank service you. When they do that, so thank you.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Hello, my name's Monica Beamer, and I'm a lifelong Oregonian, and I had the honor to serve as the executive director of Sisters of the Road for 12 years, and I'm on the board of the Western Regional Advocacy Project. And we, RAP puts this struggle in historic context. The United States has a long history of using mean-spirited and often very brutal laws to keep certain people out of public spaces and consciousness. Anti-Oki laws. The agricultural workers who migrated to California for work in the 1960s were generally referred to as Okies. They were assumed to be from Oklahoma, but they moved to California from other states as well. In 1937, California passed an Anti-Oki law, which made it a misdemeanor to bring or assist in bringing extremely poor people into the state. The law was later considered unconstitutional. We all, of course, know about Jim Crow laws. After the American Civil War, 1861 to 1865, most southern states passed laws denying black people basic human rights. Later, many border states followed, and these laws became known as Jim Crow laws after the name of a popular blackface character that would sing songs like Jump Jim Crow. Ugly laws. From the 1860s to the 1970s, several American cities had laws that made it illegal for people with unsightly or disgusting disabilities to appear in public. Some of these laws were called unsightly beggar ordinances. The most commonly cited law was from Chicago Municipal Code, Section 36034 stated, "No person who is diseased, maimed, mutilated, or in any way deformed so as to be an unsightly or disgusting object or improper person to be allowed in, on, or the public ways or other public places in the city, or shall therein or thereon expose himself to public view under a penalty of not less than $1, no more than $50 for each offense." Today we have broken window laws. Today's laws have their roots in the broken window theories, which hold that one person in a neighborhood is like a first unrepaired window if such a window is not immediately fixed or removed. It is a signal that no one cares. Disorder will flourish and the community will go to heck in a handbasket. A direct outcome of this theory is the introduction of legislation to criminalize the presence of homeless people in public. Current quality of life laws also take a certain population into account, homeless persons. Using these laws, people are criminalized for walking, standing, sleeping, and other regular human behaviors. In other words, they are penalized and harassed simply because of who they are, just as Jim Crow, ugly laws, Anti-Oki laws, Operation Wetback, and many other laws. Senate Bill 629 and the Right to Rest bills in Colorado and California are a vital part of a Civil Human Rights Act for Justice that I'm proud to be a part of, and I hope that you will join us.
Great. Thank you both very, very much. With that, I believe that concludes the list of everybody that I have that signed up on the sheets of paper, and we're right about at 5 o'clock. Is there anybody that thinks they signed up on the piece of paper that I missed? No? Well, I want to thank you all very much. This has been just a very moving and compelling hearing. Oh, yes, you signed up? Oh, you're just putting your hands up. All right, very good, very good.
Yeah, we want to all go again.
Yeah. The one that didn't say anything.
Well, we'll come up with a good ringtone for that. But thank you all so much for taking the time to come, for speaking so honestly, this really was some of the most moving and compelling testimony that I've heard in my time in the legislature, and I look forward to working with Senator Shields on the next steps. So thank you all so much for coming. Committee, thank you for being so attentive and staying a little late. I deeply appreciate it. And with that,
it's an honor, really. Thank you,
Madam. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 629, and our committee is adjourned.